The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. Can you hear me okay? So, a few of you here know one of our dear Sangha members by the name of Cheryl Gassner, who was in the hospital last month and was back at the hospital on Thursday. Those of you who don't know Cheryl, she was one of the kind of founding people for our community here. She was very instrumental in the time that we bought this building and organized. She was on the board, organized many things for us, and was very dear to us. And then she took in the hospital Thursday and took a turn for the worse over the weekend. And last night she died. And so it's a kind of a, for our community as a whole, it's kind of a big thing that this should happen. And she died, she used to work at Stanford. She was a nurse practitioner, and her specialty was the illness that killed her. And she had something called Marfan syndrome, which is a connective tissue disorder. And she started the National Marfan Foundation. And she lived to be quite long for someone with her kind of connective tissue disorder, though quite short in other ways. So she was really well known. She hadn't worked at Stanford for many years because of her illness, but she was known by many of the doctors who cared for her there, were good friends of hers from long ago. I was there last night, last period of time for her, and it was very touching to see these. I think it was three Stanford doctors, the cardiologist people, just they could see all this love they had for her. And at the end of at 1 o'clock at night, I asked him, one of them, I said, you know, I was kind of looked at him puzzled and I said, is this your shift? Because he was just there all the time. And he said, no, he was there because of Cheryl. So Steve, her husband, was there and I was there. So I was up there, you know, I was up pretty late. So partly because I was tired much of the day, and partly because of, you know, the big impact of this on me, I didn't think of a talk to give. So what I thought we would do instead, or I was hoping we would do, if you guys will participate, is maybe we can have some kind of discussion. Perhaps you have some questions about practice or the Dharma or something that's important for you, or perhaps you have some topic you want to bring up for some discussion. So we do this periodically, and I find it valuable to do it that way, because then I kind of find out what's going on with you. I don't really find out much about you if I just sit up here and have a monologue. Which I did, so. And they say in Buddhism that you create really good karma for yourself if you ask questions. There we go. Oh, about Cheryl, I wanted to say, so there's going to be a cremation on Friday for her, and then late Friday afternoon and Saturday and Sunday, her husband Steve, he has kind of Jewish background, so he's going to do something equivalent to what he calls Shiva. He's going to be home at his house. And for those people who know them, they're welcome to come by and see him over the weekend or Friday late afternoon. And I think on our website, in a couple of days, we'll post his address. So please.
Actually, I don't have a question, but my mom passed away. I haven't even really cried about it for a while, but it was in August. And this just brings up a lot of feelings. But what I wanted to say was that if I did not have this practice, I really don't think I would have been able to be so much at peace with her death.
Yes.
She was 87 years old. And she lived a long and adventurous life, and she was ready to go. And she made that pretty clear over the last year. Yeah. And when she passed away, you know, it was weird. I didn't even cry, really. I just was so happy for her. Mm. And I don't think that could have ever happened if I did not have this practice to rely on. And I don't know why I'm crying now, but it's weird. But and my father, who is also 87, did not handle this well at all. He's 65, or they were married for 65 years. We just moved him a couple weeks ago to an assisted living care. Well, they live way up in Northern California, but we moved him down to San Jose so we could be closer. And he's not handling it well at all. Mm. And I saw him on Sunday, and I looked in his eyes, and there's no life there. Mm. Really just no life at all. He's very, how do I say it? It's like he's so lost. He's just so completely lost, and he just sees what's left of his life to be so pointless. And I'm trying really hard to figure out what I can say to him. Like, what has this practice taught me? And I'm not even really sure what to say to him, except that, I don't know. You know, it's hard because now my mom died suddenly. There was kind of no, she got really sick, went to hospital, and she was dead in a very short time. And it was easier to handle because I think I knew she was ready. My father has no clue. He's not ready. And I don't know what to do with it, you know?
Yeah, so my sympathies for you and for your father. And it's hard what you're going through. So maybe if I may go a little bit roundabout in my response. So I talked to Cheryl on Friday when she was in the hospital. And she was pretty chipper. And I saw her when I was in the hospital last time. I saw her periodically. And I've known her for a long time. And it was really clear that she wasn't exactly ready to die, but she was really at peace with dying. And at the same time, I felt in her a really strong will to live. It was a kind of very nice combination, I thought, of this, you know, complete willingness or peacefulness, peaceful attitude about dying. And then this very strong will to, you know, see what she could do to stay alive. And a lot of that, I believe, is because Cheryl had practiced for a long time. And, you know, she'd done a lot of practice, been on retreats, been very intent, very good practitioner. And I think, you know, we don't talk about it enough, but one of the really important functions of this kind of practice is to prepare us in situations like this, both for our own death, but also for when there's people around us. On Friday, we have a chaplaincy training program here, and Buddhist chaplains who are going to go work in hospitals. I'm still with you, if you allow me to kind of go meander here. So Cheryl died yesterday, and I was sitting in the room with Cheryl and her husband. We were talking, and this, one of the Stanford chaplains walked in and said, "I'm the chaplain." And Steve said, "Well, I have my own chaplain." He pointed to me. I don't think he was. So I got up and stood aside so they could have a talk. But we have our chaplaincy training program here, Buddhist chaplaincy stuff, and we had a guest chaplain come in who'd been used to work as a hospital chaplain. And she told of a story from when she worked in the hospital. And she brought it up as kind of a scenario that then the people in our training could reflect on. You know, what would you do? And she was called into the emergency in the hospital. And a 4-year-old boy had just died. And suddenly. And the father was furious, and he was yelling in the emergency room so everybody could hear, blaming everyone left and right, just wouldn't stop his fury and his anger. And the mother was completely withdrawn, pulled into herself, and, you know, disappeared, wasn't quite there. And she was asked, my friend was asked to come as a chaplain. The nurses or doctors called her in to deal with this. What do you do? So one of the things that's quite something is that she had the willingness to step into that world. She didn't know what to do. Actually, she talked about that really important part of her was actually not knowing. And knowing just gets in the way. But going in there and just being willing to be present and to listen and to help bring forth what is there. And the idea of being a deep listener. And for her, it was her years of practice that gave her the capacity to enter into that kind of world. And it's really an amazing, wonderful gift to the world that there are people who have done the inner work preparation that they're able to step into that world. I mean, could you do that? And how many of you could actually do that and survive in that kind of great challenge? So I think, you know, this kind of practice of being mindful, of being present, meditating, is a very, very powerful thing to do. And it has this kind of preparation. So what to do for your father, I don't know. What to do for your father. But my take would be the first thing is not to tell him much at all. Not to try to do something or fix him, but to bring your practice, the years of practice, the practice you have, and meet him. Be present for him. Really be there with him. And then try to listen to him and try to listen to his challenges, his sorrow. I mean, he just lost his wife, you know. It can go a long time that someone like that is, you know, it's a huge, huge transition. And so listen, be present, be with that. Acknowledge it in some simple way and receive it from him. And, you know, you might do him a huge disservice if you're trying to explain to him how to see it differently. If you tell him, you know, let me just tell you about this Buddhism stuff. I have this book. So I think it begins there. Be present, and you might have to spend a lot of time. If you really want to help your dad, spend a lot of time just being with him. I think spiritual caregiving is very inefficient. And I said that recently at I went to a benefit. I was kind of I don't know what to call it, but a lead speaker, I guess, something like that, for Zen Hospice in San Francisco had a benefit to raise money for itself. And I was supposed to be kind of like this, you know, person who speaks there. And it was a benefit. So I thought, that's good. So one of the things I wanted to say, I wanted to encourage people to donate to Zen Hospice. It's a good thing to donate to. And that's what I said. I said, spiritual caregiving is inefficient. And it takes a lot of time and care. And in order for the best values in a human being to come forth and really be present for situations like that, you can't look at a clock and say, I'm going to go in there in 10 minutes, kind of deal with, you know, and move on to the next person. You know, if you monetize it, and you know, try to be as monetarily as efficient as you can, it doesn't work. And I think some of the best ways in which human beings can be together take a lot of time and are, you know, in a conventional way, kind of inefficient time-wise and money-wise. So that's why it's so important for people like to donate to places like Zen Hospice, because the other systems for financial ways of making this thing work in our societies seems to me to get more and more in the direction of, you know, efficiency. And then it has its value, but then what's lost is the values of the heart, the things that make us most human. So someone else.
I've always been curious about your kind of perception of the Buddha and how he came to get his insight. I know when he first saw suffering, when he left the palace, that was part of what triggered his awareness. But then what did he do as a as like an activist, as a from a political kind of a social transformation role? I've been traveling around the country on a number of projects over the last couple of months and have been at all these Occupy sites in the cities. And I've thought many times as I've been kind of connecting and working to collaborate with some of these groups, what would the Buddha do?
He went around occupying India.
Well, and so I'm not sure if my understanding of the Buddha's history as being like he went and talked to different kings and different leaders and tried to enroll them. So I'm just really curious about your take on the action he took in his life to the issues at hand in his life and the role that he saw that he played, and just to hear your comments on that.
It's a great question, and a reasonable question. And it's also very hard to, and it's, you know, nice to go look for inspiration back there. It might be more useful to look for inspiration in modern Buddhists, if you want Buddhist inspiration or examples, because the world of the Buddha was so radically different than anything we have today that, you know, it's the people who are somehow connected to the modern world who are figuring out how to do it here in a way the Buddha was figuring out in his time and place. But a few things, you know, ask me my view of it. Lately, my view of the Buddha was that, you know, they say that the popular idea is that the Buddha, you know, left home, left the palace, became a renunciant, and people get upset. You know, how could he have left the home and renounced everything, left everything behind? But if you understand the life the Buddha left behind, he didn't have, you know, a nice suburban home with kids and station wagon and dog and just kind of walked away from it or something. The way that it's a legend, right? It's a myth. It's probably not true. This story of how the Buddha left home, left the palace, first appears about 500 years after he died. So, you know, probably a myth, right? But the story as it goes is that his father would try to protect him from becoming, you know, protect him so he could do the family business, so he could be a king. And the father thought that if he saw the suffering of the world, he's not going to stay. And so he kept him protected in palaces where every possible, and these myths describe, every possible sensual delight is offered to him in tremendous abundance, just overdone. And so he had a very protected life, disconnected from real life. And he was already separate from real life, even though he was home, so-called home, but his home was disconnected. And then somehow or other he left the palace a few days and saw what was going on, saw sickness, age, old, and death. When he was 26, imagine what it would be like if you lived, you know, where would it be equivalent, like, I don't know what, this comes to mind, I don't know what, Hertz Castle, you know, you know, Larry Ellison's place up in Woodside, you know, and you never left. And everybody who was sick or old or dying was never let near your compound, and you grew up there, and every possible delight and recreation and TV and computers, but every possible delight means, like, for a guy, you know, they described it, you know, in great detail in the ancient texts, all the women and you know, after a while, you know, if you do that until you're 26, and then you look over the wall and say, wait a minute. He saw life as it really is, the way he was protected. So when the Buddha left his palace, left home, I think he didn't really leave. What he left, in a sense, he left behind for sure, but what he actually did was he entered the world. That was his entry into the world. And I think that, you know, in that kind of myth, I think you would do the same thing, probably. If you were that separated and disconnected, you would enter the world too, plunge into it. And he plunged in. And the only way that was available to him in ancient India, there was no other way but to go off and become a renunciant. Because there were no meditation centers to go to. There was no scholarships to get to go to university and study. There was no IMC down the street. The only options to really explore, to plunge in deeply in ancient India, was to become a renunciate. And then he discovered something profound, really meaningful. And his radical act, or, you know, for the world, was he taught it to others. And he went around India teaching people for some 40 years. And you know, the proof is in the pudding, you know, the effectiveness of what he had to teach, because we're all here today because of that, and, you know, all around the world. And it's made a huge impact on people. But what did he get involved in the politics of his time, or, you know? And scholars who, you know about the ancient, you know, something about the ancient world say that he had to be very circumspect about how he got involved in politics with kings, because kings didn't have much patience and didn't care how long heads stayed on top of shoulders. And so, you know, you put up a, you know, occupy tent in the palace courtyard, you know, you get more than pepper spray. So if he was going to be effective, he couldn't protest the injustices of his time. That was wasn't the option, that kind of totalitarian kind of regime, to do anything about it. And so his way of engagement seems to have been much more quiet. He had friendships with kings. He would counsel them. There are stories of them coming to him and getting advice, and Buddha, you know, quietly giving a little bit indirect advice that suggests you don't go to war. Not a good idea. And then he created this alternative culture, alternative community, as a model of a different way of living. And some people have looked back at the Buddhist monastic community as a kind of a utopian community, in that it's a particular, you know, compared to authoritarian, totalitarian kind of way of the kings in time of the Buddha, he created one of the early democracies of India, maybe the first democracies of India. It was a relatively democratic community where all the monks were expected. If you read the ancient texts, they describe the laws of the monastic. They all had to vote. They all had to participate in elections and had equal vote. And so maybe he couldn't change society, but he could change people's hearts, which he did, hopefully for the better. He taught ethics. He taught how to change your heart. And then he created this alternative community that was an example. And I think that we can still learn a lot from the monastic example. Even if we don't want to become monastics, the way that they organized themselves and cared for each other. And something like the Occupy movement, it's quite inspiring to see how some of these movements, how they organize themselves, and, you know, it's kind of this anti-authoritarian, consensus-based approach to life, to dealing with things. And I suspect that even there, there's things to learn from the example of the ancient monastics. So that's a long answer, but I don't know if that's satisfying or appropriate to your question. Or yes, behind you, in the back row.
I'm curious about why the mind gets fixated on things that go wrong. If at any given moment, you probably have 999 things that go right, probably one thing that goes wrong, but the mind gets fixated on the one thing that goes wrong. Yeah. You're probably spending a disproportionate amount of time.
Yeah, I think you have the numbers wrong. It's 99.999999% that's basically going right, because the amount of things that have to work right for us to get through this world, I mean, it's just the physiology of the body. It's probably even more nines at the end. And so that's that 0.00000001% that we have some role in, that we get all neurotic about, right? That's the question, why? Yes. I don't know why, but logically it makes some sense that we focus on where we can have some agency, where we can do something about it. And you find in Buddhism there's kind of a wonderful play or dance, balance, between learning to trust very deeply that 99.99999%, trusting something that's not our agency, not our doing, and relaxing. It's a very important part, giving up control, on one hand. On the other hand, learning how to understand how to use our capacity for agency, for doing things, to make change, to take some control, to be involved in choosing consequences that are beneficial for ourselves. And the balance of those two and how they go together is a huge part of the approach to Buddhist practice, because some people fixate, as you said, on when it's, you know, I'm changing a little bit the topic, so, but the they'll fixate on their agency. It's up to me. I have to do something, and it's all about the self. And if it's all about the self, and you build up yourself, it gets really complicated fast. And people sometimes will spin out or dig their own graves, because once you have created the self that has to do everything, it's impossible. But you have to have some agency. If you just sit back and say, I'm just going to trust. Or if you get fixated on all the ways in which you're the victim, which is some people do, rather than, everything's attacking me. And, that also, just kind of, all you do is trust, or all you do is relax and become the victim. That doesn't work either. So how do you do both? And so it takes some care to notice, understand your own mind, how your mind works. So it's beautiful that you point this out. Somewhat apologetically to say this to you, but the first thing that almost immediately my mind did listening to you was, why is he saying it in the abstract? why don't you take more responsibility and say, why is it my mind? Why does my mind fixate? And now that's what I think good Buddhist teachers maybe are supposed to do, is to say, hey, why don't you don't speak so abstractly. Let's get real here, and let's look. Because the answer has to be in you, not some abstract answer. So why do you fixate? Do you have any? I'm serious. Do you have any thoughts?
That's what I'm trying to figure out.
You're trying to figure it out?
Yes.
But why are you interested, then?
Because I just don't think it's a natural state. If you look at nature, everything is created in harmony. This just feels unnatural. I mean, you shouldn't have to work hard to be in a state of equilibrium. So there's something seems wrong with that.
Mm. Yeah. Something seems wrong. I don't know. Maybe there's nothing wrong with that, because there has to be death. And death is loss of equilibrium. I mean, we don't have a system where we're free of death. You know, a system that's, so things are always unfolding and dying and changing and morphing. And things are always kind of on the edge of, disequilibrium is happening all the time. And so, the way in which, it's quite something. Yesterday evening, I was in San Francisco for a memorial service. At the end of the service, I got the phone call from Steve Gastner. It says, you have to come to the hospital because Cheryl's dying. And then Friday we had this 4-year-old boy who died. I mean, that's those things happen. What this tremendous disequilibrium. So how do we go through that? We're always being thrown off. And is it just humans who get fixated? Have you ever picked up a shelter dog that's been abused? And the shelter dog abused this little dog, and that dog will be terrified the rest of its life, for strangers, because it's been so conditioned so early. Humans are the same way. And what happens to people growing up, so much disequilibrium for a lot of people. They say that, I read in the paper, was it this week, that some of you remember the statistics better than I, but fifth of Americans now take some kind of serious psychological drugs, like antidepressant drugs. That's a huge percentage. And if you start going through all the, 20% of this and 20% of this and 20% of this, and, it becomes like the cartoon that I saw many years ago. It was a huge convention hall, big convention hall. It was the annual meeting. And spread out to all the seats, here and there were two or three people. And above, it was a big banner for the convention, and it said, Functional Families of America. So, it would be good to have equilibrium, but But I think what most people find themselves, what we have to learn is to be wise and learn how to work with the disequilibrium. And so then the task is to find our peace with that. And that's what the Buddha did. You know, he discovered how, in the midst of this kind of challenging world, to find equilibrium. But it's not, you know, it's not something to be done just overnight for most people. It's something to take serious work and engagement and depth of practice. There's a beautiful, Jack Kornfield loves to tell this story of, maybe you've read it in his books, of, in this, I think in the 1970s there was a famous swami in America named Swami Satchitananda. And apparently there was a poster of him for, you know, advertising his yoga camps or something. And there was a photo of him doing the tree pose on top of a surfboard surfing a wave. It was probably photoshopped, whatever they did back then. But the word said, you can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf. Come and practice yoga with Swami Satchitananda. So thank you for the question and concern.
So you were just describing practice as work and many years of work.
Sometimes it's play.
Well, that was exactly my question, because I was asked this evening if I had enjoyed the times that I meditated this weekend, and it left me speechless because it feels like work. So that's my question, is the mix of enjoyment versus work. Uh-huh.
It can be all of the above, and hopefully over time it is. But I think, you know, again, I think I feel a little very careful. I want to be very caring or careful answering you, because it's very easy for someone like me to try to teach and give the impression that there's a particular way it has to be, and everyone has to kind of fit into this mold or something. And it's really a matter of understanding yourself. So you say it's work for you. So then your task, I would say, is to look more carefully at that. You know, why do you call it work? What are you doing that you call it work? And what's the consequences of that work? And are there some ways you can experiment and do it other ways? Can you back off and, you know, can you take on the idea of play? I've occasionally, a couple of times in my life, meditated pretending that I'm playing a pinball machine. You know, those thoughts. so that was kind of fun and different. I got bored after a while, but for a while, it was kind of fun. And it was probably, I don't remember anymore why I did it, but my guess it was better than the alternative. And then I was reminded recently that there were a couple of times on retreats where I didn't feel like I was getting concentrated, and I thought it would be good to get concentrated. So I found something, I don't know what it was, balls, I don't know, it wasn't balls, but something, and I started juggling. And by juggling, you have to be concentrated. And so I got myself kind of more concentrated, and when I was juggling, I was doing it, then all these concerns and thoughts fell away, because I could get more focused on the balls than I could on my breath. And so then I sat down more concentrated. So, it's fun, so can you experiment with play, but... So to experiment, to trial and error, but to, most importantly, to look more deeply. What's going on for you? What are your understandings? What are you trying to do? What are you running away from? What's your intention? What's your relationship to what is here? And just kind of keep unpacking and looking and looking. That's where, it all kind of unfolds. So I think, sometimes I've thought of my practice, my Buddhist practice that I've had done all these years. It's kind of like I'm married to this practice. And marriage can be pretty good. This. Sometimes. Or, you know, you have your challenges and you have your difficulties and you have your joys and you have the whole kind of like catastrophe, right? And so, or, you know, I think it was Mother Teresa who said something like that. You know, Mother Teresa was married to Jesus. That's kind of what they get the understanding, I guess, when they get ordained. And so, you know, she said something like, you know, yeah, sometimes it's really hard with my husband. So, yeah, so it's everything. It's all the above. So hopefully at some point you'll also enjoy it and have fun and...
Your image of the pinball machine, I did come up with an image of when we were kids, we would pick up a lizard and you can stroke its belly and it'll eventually calm down.
Oh.
So I had this image of my brain as a lizard.
It's probably a reptilian brain that needs to be needs to be calmed down. Great, beautiful. I have sometimes the image of a meditation is like petting the cat. In part, I like this image because when the cat's on your lap and it starts purring, who's benefiting? The cat is both of you, right? Yes, so over here. The people on this side don't seem...
I just wanted to make a comment to that. For me, it's actually very helpful to... figure out when I find myself having difficulty calming my mind, what my judgment is. What is it I'm not seeing in the meditation, and what is it that I'm judging about? What is coming through, and to recognize that, and then to try and let go of judging myself within the practice.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, there's here. Good.
I was wondering how a person skillfully tries to present what they think has happened without having a lot of ego involved, without repeating over and over in different ways, explaining or defending or trying to... I wonder how that's done skillfully.
So how a person can explain what's happened.
What's happened that, like, perhaps it's been...
So that's a great question. So the first thing to ask is yourself is, why do you want to explain? are you really clear?
You know, I have a trick answer to that. It's that wisdom is supposed to be important.
That sounds like a cover.
I know it is. It definitely is. I guess in a way a person just...
So two things. One is to look at your intention. Why do you want to say it? What's going on for you? But don't take the first answer or the second answer, third answer as the final answer. Keep looking more deeply, because there's layers of intentionality. And if you settle in the first intention, you're probably not seeing what's really driving you. So it's going to... So for what purpose do I want this? Keep asking that question. Okay, now you have an answer. What purpose do I want? Keep asking and see if it goes deeper and deeper. And the second is be really careful about explaining something to someone else. For every time that you want to explain something to someone else, begin by asking them how it is for them. Ask them, you know, how is it for you? What happened there? Can you tell me how you saw that situation? Be more interested in how it is for them than how it is for you. And then you might get some very, really important information. And that information you get from other people might then inform you about what's appropriate for you to say or how to say it or when to say it. You might actually be much more skillful in how you talk if you've understood them really well.
What if you don't want to put them on the spot to get them involved in the...
Well, you know, I know that you're... I don't know what you're talking about, but I know you have a strong tendency towards being political. So... That tends to be polarizing pretty quickly. So you have to be very careful and skilled then in how you ask, and not come with rhetorical leading questions like, right. How could you be stealing all the oil from all our grandchildren for? How could you? I think it's really helpful to, when you're actually talking to individual people, to assume that the people are good. They might not always be skillful in their actions and stuff, but the people are good. So to approach them with respect and dignity and ask them, how is it for you? But not as a leading question, not as a way to kind of, get what you want to see happen, but to find out. So in terms of kind of a little bit of politics, remember, so when I was in college, I was at UC Davis before they had pepper spray. And Davis was, I still probably is, a great agricultural school, and I was there getting a degree in agriculture. And I was interested in alternative agriculture and organic farming and things like that. And I was an activist on campus, and we did all kinds of things to try to develop that whole thing. And I was turned out in retrospect, I was a fundamentalist organicist. when I started there, and I had some really strong fixed ideas, and self-righteous ideas about organic farming and commercial farming and pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers and all that. Most of those ideas were received from the kind of organic movement. And then I started taking the science classes and looking more deeply at the science behind all these things. And I found that as I understood the science of it, some of my organic beliefs weren't true. And I felt really kind of, what's the word, English word? Chastened or something? Chagrined or,
Chastened.
Humbled or... Not embarrassed enough. I'm telling you. No, but I kind of humbled. I felt alarmed because I saw that what I'd done and how I had divided up the world, good and bad, by basically holding on to these really strong ideas. And I've learned from that since then that it's really easy to have really simple ideas and have very strong opinions of what's right and wrong. And it really behooves to kind of investigate and study and learn and realize that sometimes it's much more complicated, all the different issues. And sometimes it takes, it's good to do a lot of homework. So to ask someone else, how is it for you? With a sense that you're doing your homework, you're actually discovering, more information, more aspects of the picture is, I think, a wise thing. So those two things, look at your intention and ask, explore before you talk. Okay, so I hope that was okay tonight. And thank you for those who have asked questions and those of you who listened. Thank you for being here and practicing. And it was very nice for me to come here today and to meditate with all of you. And it felt very nice for me. I don't know what it's like for you, but it felt very nice to be here in the room and very still. And I thank you for that time together.